Howdy, buckaroos. My name is Myers Raymer. I'm a recovered alcoholic. I remember when Brent asked me to do this. He said, I said, Brent, you really have the times right on that? You talk about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, right? And he said, yeah. And I said, 3 o'clock on Saturday afternoon, you're going to have, there'll be 20 people in here. You really want to have me come do this? And he said, absolutely. And this room was filling up. And I was going, we're going to need a bigger room. I mean, it just freaks me out. It just, it absolutely does. I sobered up January 15th, 88. And, I talked to the evil twin, Chris. Some of you guys know him. I talked to him a little bit ago. He was in Houston, and he told me to be sure and tell you rascals Hattie, and it's a treat to be here. Any of you guys ever take a shower yet? And if you're staying here, have y'all seen those towels? They're the coolest. These towels are, listen, it won't be a big thing to you. I was raised in a family where we had a towel. A towel. And this thing, I'm telling you right now, guys, this is the coolest towel in the whole wide world. I want to go back and just lay on it. It's the man. I do want to thank Brent. I want to thank committee. I want to thank, it's a big deal. It takes a lot of effort to do these kind of things. And much more so for years in the rooms, I'd sit back and I'd go, you know, if those guys would do it like I would, and I had a head full of ideas until one day about 15 years ago, somebody said, okay, you can chair next year's deal. And I went, and I never worked so hard in my whole life. It was a year of commitments, a year of doing things, and I'm just honored to be here in the same room with you. Frank, my new best friend, picked me up at the airport and schlepped me over here. Like I got some of you guys that have done this, that have traveled a little bit like this, and I've talked to some of you that have. Sometimes the most uncomfortable time of an entire weekend is when somebody picks you up at an airport and is carrying you back to a conference like that, because you don't know who you're in a car with. I mean, is he drunk? Is he a big book guy? Is he a little disco drunk that doesn't, you know, oh, I just hate that big book. And then I've got 2 hours of sitting here like this, staring at the windshield. Because, buddy, I don't have anything to talk about. If you don't like the big book, we've got a problem. But you don't ever know until you're in the car. And so you kind of, it's this weird game that everybody plays. He says something, and then I say something, and then he says something, and I say, and pretty soon he'll say something that snaps, and I go, okay. And then my shoulders drop a little bit, and I'm okay. And then coming in with Frank, I wished our drive had been 3 hours instead of 3 minutes. I mean, it was the craziest deal like that. What a guy. I'm a third generation drunk. My grandfather was a drunk. My dad's a drunk. My identical twin is a drunk. And I am. Crazy sort of thing. I have so much other stuff that I want to talk about. Yep, we're going to talk about some sponsorship stuff. We're going to talk about some carrying the message stuff. I got so much other stuff. I don't want to talk a whole lot of war story stuff. But I will say this. I'm a functioning alcoholic. I owned a bookbindery for 34 years, and I operated a great deal of that drunk. I operate just fine loaded. Thank you very much. And it didn't get bad until it got bad. I don't know how to say that. It's just like it's good until it's not. And I go from being able to drink a case of beer and a bottle of vodka a day, and you'd never know that I had anything to drink. And all of a sudden, I'm drinking 3 beers, and I can't talk, and I'm walking into walls. It's like physically, I just got to this place where things got really stupid. Chris introduces me, the evil twin in this case, introduces me to the some outside issues, which sort of sped things up, if you catch my drift. And I got really, really, really scared. I got real nervous. I got real, if you can imagine, I'm trying to maintain this alcohol, and I'm trying to prop it up with all this other stuff so that I can drink more. And in the end, what's happening is that I'm becoming very, very angry. I'm becoming very, very frustrated with everybody. I can't go to the grocery store anymore. I can't go to church anymore. I can't go to anywhere where I might have to act civilized. I can't go. And it's pretty frustrating. In the last 6 months that I drank, I got arrested twice for trying to beat up a liquor store clerk, and another time in a pizza place. A guy got in front of me in the line. Not a real good idea for either one of us. And as I'm beating this guy to death with a beer pitcher, And one teeny tiny small detail that I wanted to throw in there, my 3-year-old daughter is standing right there while it's happening. And it gets pretty ugly. And so I get to a place to where finally, now Chris, who was working for me at the time, was 12-step by a guy that worked in our bindery. He had taken Chris to AA, and it worked. Chris never tried to sell me on some idea of AA. I always thought he would try to force it down my throat and do it. He didn't. What he did was he lived a sober life, and his actions, I'm going to be where I say I'm going to be. I'm going to do what I say I'm going to do. This kind of stuff shouted from the rooftop that here was a guy that was rearranged. Because Chris, the evil twin, he's always the guy that we always knew was going to be a disaster. I mean, he's the like black sheep of the family kind of guy. And I'm the upstanding twin that's got a good job and a good wife and a good education and all this kind of, wow. Chris sobers up and I watch him simply transform in front of me. 3 months after he sobered up, I'm working on a tractor. And any of you guys ever turn a wrench, you know that you don't do it in the grass. Come on. I mean, this is mechanic 101. You don't fix things in the grass because you're going to drop stuff, right? And then you got to look. So I'm trying to fix this tractor out there. I got to be real honest. It's not a real tractor. It's a lawn tractor, okay? It's just a little bitty tractor. This rigorous honesty stuff's a bitch sometimes. I'm just telling you. It's a lawn tractor, but I'm fixing it, okay? And so I keep dropping screws, and I'm getting mad, and Chris is sitting over there drinking a glass of iced tea, sitting on this stump, just watching me. And I'm just so mad. My face is beet red, and I'm trying to turn this tractor over with my bare hands. I simply cannot stand it. I just simply came apart, and I'm shaking this thing. I can't even budge it, and he looks at me, and he goes, you know, you don't have to live like this if you don't want to. And he got up and he walked inside. And I remember looking at him and I went like this. And I'm just real. Because I don't know, guys. I don't want to be like this. I don't want to be angry. I don't want to have my life. Any of you guys remember what your life was like when you first got to AA like this? I mean, my life, my whole existence was trying to go to work for a couple hours, come home, and I'd spend the rest of the evening in my garage, in my bedroom, or hiding in my Land Cruiser. I've got an old Toyota Land Cruiser, and I'd sit out there and just drink myself silly. I'd just get loaded. I couldn't go anywhere. I couldn't do anything, and it was simply a horrible, horrible existence. Finally, Chris takes me to my first meeting, and I fell in love with it. I thought it was the coolest thing in the universe. To this day, I still do. There's nothing on God's green earth I love more than these rooms and the people in them. I thought it was the coolest thing in the universe. People will talk about multiple relapses once they get to AA. I had one sobriety day, January 15th, 88, the first time I came in. Everything connected. I just snapped in place. I love the coffee. I love the girls. I love the stories. I love the girls would play a factor later that was not true good, but it was just the coolest deal. And I stayed, and for 2 years, it was the coolest thing in the world. I loved your stories. I loved being there. I loved being accepted like this, and it was great. Guys, now listen, here's where your story and my story may get goofy, okay? Because look, some of you guys were lucky enough to be in AA land where you had people that loved you and held you, and they did all the right things, and they taught you the big book, and they taught you what recovery looked like. I fell into the epicenter of middle-of-the-road solution in North Texas. There was simply no big book, no God, and no program. We had good fellowship. We had all that kind of stuff, but we simply didn't have anything else. None of us had sponsors, and it was pretty weird. It was fun until it wasn't fun. And after a while, after about 3.5-4 years into the deal, now I'm listening to your story for the 1,000th time because that's all we have. We have no program that we're talking about. So every meeting is a how we got there meeting. So we're going to listen to your story over and over and over and over again. Well, your story was fascinating the first 100 times I heard it. And then it's not fascinating anymore. As a matter of fact, it's so tedious that all I can think about is choking the living crap out of you. And this is not the way sober people should behave, okay? I'm just telling you. There needs to be more, but I didn't know. And I would stay, and I would stay, and I would stay, and it finally got so bad about 7 years into the deal. 7 years from my last drink and my last outside issue, I'm suicidal. Every day I think about it. I'm writing hot checks all over Denton County. I got a burn rate on credit cards that would scare you. Every woman in AA is more exciting than my wife. every woman. And that is not a good thing if you want to stay married. My wife is baffled by my behavior. I'm sober in big quotation marks, okay? Y'all read sober, okay? I'm sober. I haven't used anything, and yet I'm as crazy. Y'all get that, right? I'm nuttier than a squirrel turd, and I cannot figure out a way to make it happen. My wife is distraught. She's now moved. She's moved to the other end of the house. She's got everything packed up. We have two daughters by now, and she's got everybody all gathered up, and they're getting ready to move to Houston. And I'm coming apart. I almost drank one night. It scared me really bad. I didn't want to drink. I said, I got to make sure that we're real clear about this. At 7 years into this deal, even as ugly as my life had become in the rooms of AA, I didn't want to drink. I don't want to do that. And it scared me real bad. And I called Chris. Now, Chris has now moved to the Hill Country, got a sponsor, a big book sponsor. Don't know what that was. Didn't care. But the thing, here's the important part. Every time Chris called, he was happy. Every time we talked, he was happy. And I'm thinking, what? So I called him and told him what happened. And he said, buddy, he said, I'm going to introduce you to somebody. We're coming to Houston in a couple of days. His then sponsor, Mark Houston, was going to be in Dallas. And they went and saw this old guy. And then he called me the next day and he said, oh, you're not going to believe this guy. He's old as dirt and he's really mean and he's perfect for you. I went, I don't get that. And he said, just go do it. I got some other stuff I want to talk about. I'm not going to take a bunch of time, but our connection was something that was fairly magical. He's asking me all these questions about AA. I don't know any of them. I'm telling you, he's lobbing grapefruits at me. He's asking me questions like, who were the co-founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, Myers? Some old dudes? I don't know. I don't care. Who? I don't care. And I didn't. And it's a, but finally I realized that unless I started getting honest with him, he was just going to keep asking me these questions. And eventually I just told him, I said, Clifford, you can stop asking me those questions because I don't know the answer to any of them. And he said, finally, we're making some progress. Here's my big book. Don't ever come back over here without a big book. And I'll see you tomorrow night at the meeting. Yes, sir. There it was. And I'm just thinking. And I spent the next day trying to talk myself out of going, but there was something in me that said that I'd die if I didn't go, that I needed to go do this thing. Walk in, it's a big book study. They have three big book studies a week. They're all big book studies. There's no discussion. 26 years that group's been there, there's never been a discussion meeting. It's all big book studies. I'm not digging it. I'm hating it about as bad as you think I'm going to hate it. I mean, I'm just like this. I'm sitting in a meeting judging everything that they do and everything that they say. And you Nazis, I'm pretty rough with them. Not verbally. I'm not saying anything because I'm too big of a coward. But I'm going to sit in the back of the room and just simply judge everything that they said. And they'd say something about the big book, and I'd get rankled. If they said something that bumped up against my sensitivity, I would rebel I'm not going to ever come back to this stupid meeting. And then the next meeting, I'd be standing there, you know, sitting there. Because somewhere deep inside, I had this feeling that the things that they were saying. Well, so let me tell you what happened. So I get there one night on a Thursday night, and some lady's talking about something like this, and she gives this description, just like she read just a minute ago, this of what alcoholism looks like. She's not sharing drama. She's not sharing war story. She's talking about a face that looks like alcoholism, a physical component and a mental component. She's talking about a spiritual malady that sort of drives this whole thing. She starts like this, and I'm going like, and after the meeting, Philip Files standing there like this, and he goes, hey, are you okay, Myers? And I said, Philip, you're not going to believe this, dude. I'm an alcoholic. And he goes, no kidding. I thought we had that figured out. I said, man, you may have it figured out, but I'm telling you, buddy, I know, I understand for the very first time what it looks like to be an alcoholic. I could explain it. I could teach it. I knew. And it was the most freeing thing in the universe. The voices in my head that kept trying to talk me out of being crazy, it went away. I knew what I was. I went home and kicked the front door open and ran in, scared the crap out of my wife. I ran in and I said, Londa, I'm an alcoholic. And she's just looking at me going like, wow. Yeah, I know. And I said, no, sweetheart, you don't understand. I completely get this. And everything changed, guys. Everything began to shift from there. I stopped judging them. I stopped playing goofy games with them. I just simply could not wait to get there. We started connecting up dots, and I started going, oh, that's Jim's story in the front of the book. That's that Jay Walker guy. I just thought that was a stupid story. I didn't realize they were talking about me. Like, that's the kind of stuff that's happening like this. And I'm getting all gathered up. I'm getting all excited about what it's going to be like. Do I want to? Oh, yes, I will. Oh, listen, okay, I'm going to. Okay. Well, look, because I can go two different directions here right now. And I just. Okay. I want to make some observations. Okay. I want to make sure we're clear here, okay? I'm not knocking AA, okay? I'm not going to make you repeat it, but I want to make sure you understood what I said. I am not knocking AA. Everybody always says, you're just taking AA's inventory. I am a little bit. I am. Because I want you to understand, guys, that you may have grown up and you may have come up through the ranks in AA in a warm and fuzzy place where you were taught these things. But I'm telling you, as a man who travels 30 some odd weekends out of the year, that there are huge geographic areas in the United States. God forbid if you're in Europe right now. I'm talking huge areas where there's nobody doing AA like AA. I mean, it's a weak imitation of what AA looks like. There's some meetings. There's a circle and triangle on the door. But past that, guys, it's the craziest thing. I was in, I can't tell you where it was. I was in a place about a year and a half ago. And when I got back, I got an email from this lady. And she said, oh, I can't believe we missed you. My husband's relapsed and I wanted to meet you. And I didn't even know you were going to be wherever this town was. And she said, I said, well, tell me how your husband's doing. Is he back in the room yet? And she goes, oh, yeah, he's doing good. He's doing fine. I said, well, does he have a sponsor yet? Has he gotten plugged in? He goes, oh, well, no, he's not back involved in AA yet. And I said, well, I'm having a hard time understanding. Is he sober? Yes. Well, what's he doing? And he goes, well, they told him he couldn't come back to AA until he'd been sober 30 days. I mean, this stuff. There's two places I can tell you right now in Texas where they're charging money to listen to Fifth Steps. Charging money to listen to Fifth Step, because I'm fairly skeptical about these things. I said, so tell me, how much does it cost to get a Fifth Step? And you know what the guy said? How good a Fifth Step do you want? I understand it, guys, but this has been going on for 15 years. This Fifth Step stuff, charging money to hear these Fifth Steps, have been going on for 15 years that I know of, and nobody says a word about it. Everybody just looks the other way, and this is the stuff that gets me on this stuff. Guys, I answer emails for 2 hours every morning, 7 days a week, for 2 hours every morning, and most of them are for people who are in trouble, who are dying in AA, sitting in rooms, just trying to stay sober, going to a bunch of meetings. Listen, look at me. I love AA, and I love meetings. But nowhere in our literature, nowhere in that precious book of ours does it say that your sobriety centers around going to a meeting. And that's my only problem. I just don't understand why we have this love affair with the meeting at the expense of the steps, at the expense of finding a good sponsor that will teach me what I need to do to get plugged into a power greater than me that could take me to a place I've never been before. Do you understand that? Listen, I'm proof positive that you can go to thousands and thousands of meetings and not make it. The largest single group of people in the United States that are relapsing today are people in 12-step recovery groups. Meetings do not treat alcoholism. They treat loneliness better than anything I know. They treat some other things really, really well. But listen, guys, let me just tell you something. Come on, y'all with me here on this kind of stuff. I know this makes some of you feel real uncomfortable because you love your meeting. Rock on. But why is it that we have so many meetings where the mention of God brings people to tears? They get angry physically. Why is it that if you start talking about the steps and start talking about a transforming experience, they get all goofy? We just assume you didn't come back over here. Listen, there's a meeting in Dallas right now where if you get out of your truck and walk across the parking lot, we all have trucks in Texas, right? And I'm walking across the thing, and I got a big book. This guy says, what's that? And I said, it's my big book. It's just got a different cover on it. And he goes, well, we don't use that over here. You can put that back in the truck. I'm not going to tell you what I told him. But we started the meeting and finished the meeting with my big book sitting in front of me, okay? Crazy stuff. Crazy stuff. I need more time. Okay, listen. Some of you guys that were around in 1971, you guys remember, I graduated from high school in 72, so that'll show you how old I am. And I know I look like Moses, but I'm not that old, honest. In 1971, when President Nixon got out of office, the very last piece of legislation that he signed into law was this thing called the Hughes Act that gave teeth to the treatment center industry, and it did what the AMA had been doing for a long time, but it gave it bigger teeth. And it was a pretty cool deal. There was a lot of pros and cons about it and this kind of stuff. But let me tell you what happened, guys, that I thought was fairly interesting like that. That within a short period of time, from 1936, I think we found that from 1935 to 1971, that's 36 years. It took us 36 years to get 500,000 people in our fellowship. 36 years to get 500,000 members in the deal. Once the Hughes Act was signed into law in 1971, in the next 5 years, 1971 to 1976, we added another 500,000 members. The treatment centers were spitting them out left and right. Now, I'm not making the treatment industry the culprit. I work in the treatment industry. I'm not making them the culprit, but they played a role in what was to come down the pike. Now, this is the part that we need to own here, and I want us all to be real clear about this stuff. What happened was, when people send weird stuff to you, it's our responsibility to know what's weird, right? And yet we didn't know. We'd spent years and years and years clinging tenaciously to this idea that we could keep each other sober by just going to a whole bunch of meetings. There was a grain of truth to some of that, but in the big picture, what we ended up with was a bunch of people. Treatment was bringing in a bunch of ideas and stuff, and there was a crazy bunch of stuff that was going on, and we just sat back and said, groovy. That's super. And we just let this stuff happen. And so what we ended up with is, we ended up with people that did not belong in AA. They weren't alcoholic. Nobody had ever qualified them. Listen, you want to get somebody stirred up. You want to get somebody real rankled in a meeting. Start talking as a topic one time for a discussion deal. Just mention qualifying the drunk and watch how angry people get. We're not trying to keep anybody out of AA. I'm just saying this like that. But you go back and look at the historical data around Alcoholics Anonymous guys, and these guys spent an inordinate amount of time qualifying the man sitting in front of him to let him know whether he was the real deal or whether he was not. We're not trying to be exclusionary to anybody. But come on, guys. If you're not an alcoholic, why do you want to be here? Why is this a problem? Let me tell you why it's a problem. Because a lot of times they're the most vocal guys in the room. And so we have a man or a woman who is not an alcoholic sharing in a discussion meeting over and over and over again about stuff that they don't know anything about. They're not us. Nobody ever qualified them. How do I know this? I've spent years talking to people that fit that model. Years. This doesn't happen occasionally. It happens lots of times. Come on. Do you have to be an alcoholic to get a DWI? Of course you don't. There are tens of thousands of people in the United States every year that get DWIs that were just in the wrong place at the wrong time with booze on their breath, and they get a DWI. Where does the judge do? You need to go to AA. And so they're there. Are they welcome? You bet. Requirement for membership, I'm clear on, guys. My problem is that as a fellowship, we've backed away from the idea of helping them see what their truth is. Do you understand? Because we don't want to qualify because it's exclusionary. D.A. Carson, one of my favorite theologians, said one time that we drift towards compromise and call it tolerance. This is uncomfortable, guys. I know it makes some of you kind of squirmy like that. The reason this is important is because we have to shore it up someplace. We have to make sure that it doesn't keep happening like that. I want to read this to you. You'll get a kick out of this. There's a guy named Bob Bacon that's been dead for years that did a talk. He was a delegate in Ohio, and he did this talk. I'm going to read you just one little piece out of this deal. But listen to what this says. We hear a lot of ridiculous things like there are no musts in AA. My big book read different. People say that it's an individual program that we can take the steps any way we want to. Dr. Bob said, and I quote, "There is no such thing as an individual interpretation of the 12 steps." Okay, you with me? Okay, now, weeks or months later, a lady up in the Midwest sent me a text, and she said, an email, and she said, "I thought you'd get a kick out of this. This is the Grapevine Statement of Purpose, the AA Grapevine." I'm not ragging on the Grapevine yet, but I love them. Listen to this. This is out of their statement of purpose. The awareness that every AA member has an individual way of working the program permeates the pages of the Grapevine. And throughout its history, the magazine has been a forum for the varied and often divergent opinions of AAs around the world. I can't even read the rest of it. It makes me nauseated to read it like this. So what the Grapevine is saying is not only will we accept the fact that you have a bunch of divergent ideas about what's going on, we're going to print it in our meeting in print so that the new guy can come in and be totally confused. You understand what I'm saying? Guys, I'm for everybody being here. I don't have a problem with any of this kind of stuff, but I do have a problem when we get brand new guys that come in that simply don't get this thing, that are conflicted, that simply do not understand what the program really is about. Y'all understand that? Can I get an amen? Because listen, because what happens is that we end up with brand new guys. We've never had any problem getting people to come to AA, ever. We've never had a problem getting them to come. We have a problem getting them to stay. The guys that are relapsing, that are going back out again, when we look at the statistical data that we try to support this stuff with, that we try to collect over the years like this from the intergroup offices, it will make you weepy to see how many people, 20,000 a year, 30,000 a year, depending on the year like this, and then to see how many people are picking up 1 month chips. They'll pick up a desire chip, but how many of them are gone in the first month? 75% of it is about where it works out. Less than 10% pick up one-year chips. Of all the thousands of people that come, and then we sit back and want to get defiant because somebody questions what we're doing in a meeting. It's not my job to question what you do in a meeting, but it is my job to, as a brother and sister in this deal, to ask you some simple questions. Is the message the newcomer is hearing, is it what he needs to hear to recover, or is it us just sharing our day? There's a place to share that, guys. There's a venue that's good. My problem is, why is there so many of those venues at the expense of a good old book study? In our area, 1,500 meetings a week in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, there's three book studies. And one of those simply uses the big book as a launching point for a discussion place. It's pretty crazy. Any of you guys ever read that little piece that Bill Wilson wrote in 1942? Our chief responsibility to the newcomer is an adequate presentation of the program. He wrote this in 42. Our chief responsibility to the newcomer is an adequate presentation of the program. That's why we were supposed to be there. I'm not saying that all, you guys get me though, right? All God's kids got problems and we want to be there for each other like this, but not at the expense of what program looks like. Not at the expense. We see this. So, I'll let you up. I'm not going to go any more into that. Well, maybe one more little piece. Just one more little piece. On the internet, sometimes when you're back home and you're doing something, if you're you get tired of looking up weasel porn or something like this, look at. I'm kidding. There's a little deal here called Whose Responsibility. You'll just type in Bill Wilson, Whose Responsibility, and this will come up on the deal like this. And if you can't, then email me, chew me out, and then I'll send it to you anyway, okay? I'll just send it back to you as an attachment. An AA group, this was written in, he wrote this a couple of different times, but this one was printed originally in 1966. Listen to this. An AA group as such cannot take on all the personal problems of its members, let alone those of the non-alcoholics in the world around us. The AA group is not, for example, a mediator of domestic relations, nor does it furnish personal financial aid to anyone. Though a member may sometimes be helped in such matters by his friends in AA, the primary responsibility for the solutions of all of his problems of living and growing rests squarely upon the individual himself. Now, should an AA group attempt this sort of help, its effectiveness and energies would be hopelessly dissipated. And this is the part I want you to remember, this little piece of this paragraph. This is why sobriety, freedom from alcohol, through the teaching and practice of AA's 12 steps, is the sole purpose of the group. If we don't stick to this cardinal principle, we shall almost certainly collapse. And if we collapse, we cannot help anyone. Our job was to teach the steps to the newcomer, not help them with the other stuff. So some of you guys totally not digging that. And I understand, man, because I've been right there and I know what it's like to be faced with something that makes me feel uncomfortable. And the deal is that we're in a weird place in AA right now, guys. Worldwide, we have a whole bunch of crazy stuff going on. In Europe, it's just unbelievable. Everybody came up with all these translations, and New York loves to say we have this many translations, but I don't think anybody ever read the translations. Any of you guys ever read the translation of the Big Book in Russia? Have you ever seen the translation? Listen, if somebody wasn't saying, hey, that's the Big Book right there, you wouldn't know it. It's so far off in the toolies, it's not even funny. It looks like another piece of literature, and it's the same in a lot of places. You just, in Ireland, at the bottom of the page in their service manual, on one of the right toward the end of it, this is their national service manual for AA in Ireland. It says it gets kind of lengthy, and then there's a quote at the bottom of it that says the Big Book study movement is outside the confines of AA in Ireland. I'll send it to you, right out of the book. You understand what I'm saying? So if we want to sit in a meeting and listen to you share about your grandkids or share about your dilemma shopping, then we're within the confines of AA. But if we want to bring a Big Book out and have a Big Book study there, no can do, brothers. Weird, see? But we just sit back and we watch this stuff. We got to change this stuff, guys. One of the things that they taught me that blew me away was this idea about what we do around sponsorship. I'm convinced that when he asked me to sponsor, then I go okay, and I've got to raise him for the next 40 years. I got to do all this other. We got to be best buddies. We got all the. Nothing was ever said. Let me tell you, any of you guys ever do H&I stuff where you walk in and you do something like this and you realize that all of a sudden you got four or five people to sponsor? If you have to take them on to raise, you know what you're going to do? You're going to start making excuses why you can't sponsor them. And the Big Book was real clear. They wrote a whole chapter on it. There's another meeting going on right now talking just about that, chapter 7, working with others, that we were supposed to be doing this stuff. It is crazy. One of the things that these old dudes at this meeting taught me was that you could work guys through the work in a timely fashion without having to go through this whole thing for months and months and months and months and months. Because let me tell you something. You probably don't have a Big Book standing right there in front of you, but I'm going to read something to you real quick. You remember that little piece on page 24? Some of you Big Book thumpers in here like that? There's a little piece on there. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. Dig. Now listen, guys, here it is. The idea that we are going to have an unlimited amount of time and just because your butt's in a seat at a meeting that you're going to be okay and healthy enough to get and grasp what we're doing around these steps needs to be addressed. We need to start looking at it as a whole bunch and make sure that we're on point with this stuff, guys, because my experience does not bear that out. Worldwide, our guys say, well, we want them to get comfortable. We're just going to let them sit and they're going to get comfortable at our meetings and then they'll tell us when it's time to work the work. That's not been my experience. My experience is, if you're like me, that what will happen is when I get uncomfortable, what do we do? We use. We drink ourselves silly again. You bet. That's what it is that we do. We don't have that kind of time. That's the reason why if you go back and look at any historical data, go back and look at Bill's story, Fred's story, Jim's story, Bill Dotson's story, I don't care, any of them. For almost 20 years, every one of them, you'll see that these guys worked the work. Within 35 to 45 days, they were through the work completely. Completely. You see? I know it drives some of you crazy. It does. Call me. I'll show you exactly how it is. I had a guy come up after a talk one night, and he said, Myers, you can only effectively sponsor maybe one, maybe two guys in your whole career in AA. And I went, are you kidding me? And he said, I'm just telling you, man, that's it, because you've got all the stuff you got to do. And I go, whoa, 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 buddy, you fabricated a whole lot of stuff that doesn't even fit in the picture. I'm going to teach you what the steps look like. What you do with them is not my business. You see, my job is to be there to try to help you with that, and it doesn't take a lifetime to do that kind of stuff. And by the way, Hoss, if you would sponsor more, I could sponsor less. Just saying. I know. He's a mean little bastard. It's It's not that. I'm not mean. I'm not angry. I'm not anything. I get passionate about this stuff. I've seen so much crazy crud in our room. I ended up with a crazy daughter that got really loaded and ended up in our rooms, and then she relapsed, and she discovered the joys of spice, little K2 stuff. And for any of you guys out there thinking that's a groovy idea, come see me. I thought we were going to bury her that day when she sobered up. We had her in 3 hospitals in 1 day trying to get her detoxed. It was as ugly a detox as I've ever seen, and I'm in the industry. I'm just telling you, it was the craziest thing in the whole wide world. And up until a couple of months ago, it was legal in Texas. And all these little kids are walking around on psychosis, and guys are dropping like flies. It's the craziest kind of stuff like that. Just steer clear of it. For you guys that don't know, it's synthetic marijuana, and it is ugly as it can be. And I thought we were going to lose her. But let me tell you guys, what happened was when my daughters got older and they started messing around with stuff, then all of this stuff became real. It became real personal, because all of a sudden it's not just me and my program. It's, will this program be healthy enough that my daughters can find help here? I've told this story. I won't go into it now. This story out in I can't tell you where, but it's in Texas, where people were doing some crazy stuff like that. And my mind always goes there. My mind is always thinking about this stuff. Is what if my daughters, any of them, had walked into that meeting? Ask yourself the question, guys. How many of you guys walk into meetings sometimes and it looks like it's somebody's pet cemetery? Everybody looks like they just died or something. I mean, it's just everybody's sad, and everybody's like, there are hundreds of meetings in Texas that are like that I see, where you just walk in and I'm going, wait a minute, this is recovery? This is what we're supposed to be doing? It's just crazy. 2 years after I go to this primary purpose group in Dallas, 2 years after that, so now I'm sober, what is that, 7, 8, 9 years. I'm thinking that it's the coolest thing in the world. I'm digging the book. I'm digging the stuff like this, but I'm still not doing any 12-step work. So you can only get so good. Listen, I don't know how many of you guys do 12-step work. How many are out in the trenches doing this stuff? If statistically, it probably looked like about 20% of you. Statistically, it may be more here. But what happens a lot of places is you have thousands and thousands and thousands of people in our rooms who never do any 12-step work. Their whole idea is, well, my 12-step work is my meeting. Well, okay, I understand where you're going with this stuff, guys, but I want to be real clear. I've read a lot of what Bill Wilson wrote, both in the big book and out of the big book, and I never heard anything that said, step 13, go to meetings. It didn't say that. I just trying to be real clear here. And so I'm starting to suffer again. I'm better, but there's still some things going on in my life that are driving me crazy, and I'm not happy with some things. And Clifford, the crusty Cliff, the old guy that still sponsored me, he Clifford looks at me, and I said, Clifford, I don't know why I'm having trouble here. And he said, are you kidding me? And I said, no, I don't know why. And he said, Myers, you don't do any 12-step work. I said, Clifford, I drive you home 3 times a week. I'm driving you to places where you're doing 12-step work. I'm carrying your books. I'm doing all that. Isn't that 12-step work? I said, no, that's service work that makes my 12-step work possible. And I went, oh, okay. So what do you want me to do? And he said, I want you to get off your butt and go do some 12-step work. I want you to go try to help somebody, because your world is still there. So I went. I want to tell you this real. It's a real fast story, but he said, I'll see you tomorrow night at Salvation Army, and we'll do the deal. Now, he's always up there. There's a whole bunch of our guys from our group that go there, and it's a great place to go. And he's telling the truth. I mean, I would go sit, and then I'd go, as soon as the meeting was over, I'd run out the door to get on the cell phone and wait for them to get out, and then we'd leave. I didn't want to stay in there with those guys. Listen, I want to make sure we're clear. See, here's the deal. I like to talk about 12-step work. I want you to think that I do 12-step work, but I don't really want to do any of it. I'm being real honest with you, okay? Because it makes me feel uncomfortable, because they're going to ask me to do things I don't want to do, and it's going to make me feel I might look stupid, and I don't want to do that. I'm already stupid enough. I don't need to look it too. And so I said, okay, I'll be out there. And I pull up, and we get into this parking lot, and I walk in, and there's nobody else there. And I'm looking around, and Clifford's not there, and Dara's not there, and Philip's not there. And I'm thinking, man, I just got hosed. I mean, nobody from our group is there. There's 180 men in that room. 80% of them are black guys. There's a couple of little Latino guys floating around in there, and one pasty little white guy in the very back of the room. I don't know how he got in there at all, but he's there. And me, another pasty guy in the front of the room. And I'm peeing myself. I'm so nervous. I don't know. What am I supposed to do? And so I remembered where Clifford was. It was marked in my book. And I thought, well, what the heck? So I go up there, do my talk like this. They start asking questions. And pretty soon they all we had a pretty good meeting. It was pretty fun like that. And afterwards like this, we're doing the Lord's Prayer. And we drop hands. And this guy said, hey, could you come back tomorrow? And I went, yeah. And there's this, I'd been punched in the gut, and because there was a part of me that was going, I was this close to being in a place where I could milk this experience for another 2 or 3 years. Y'all get that, right? Because I'd be going, yeah, I carried that message down to Sally. Yeah, I did that. You know, I don't want to ever do it again, but that's what I was going to do. But this guy asked me to come back. And so I'm walking out of the door. But guys, by the time I got to the parking lot, I'm going, what? That guy asked me to come back. They really wanted me to come back. And guys, I'm telling you, everything began to shift in my life. It was the craziest thing in the whole wide world. And I got home that night. I walked in and I told Londa about it. And she was laughing at me a little bit. And I got up the next morning, she and I are partners in this bindery, and so I'd be at work like this, and every time she'd walk in the room, I'd be looking at the clock like this, and she said, what is going on with you? And I said, well, I got to go back over to the Salvation Army tonight and do this talk over there like this. And she goes, Myers, it's 10 o'clock in the morning. What time is the talk? And I said, well, don't worry about it. It's this evening, but I'll be all right. And so, and I made it, guys, I made it till about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and I couldn't take it anymore. And I drove home, and I took a shower, and then I laid my clothes out. I want to look sharp, you know, like this. And I'm just, for the boys at the Salvation Army, I want to look good. I don't know. It made sense at the time, but there's a piece of the story that I always want to leave out, but I'll tell you, I don't know any man that would admit to this, okay? But I'm just going to tell you, I got my man card like this, but I'm going to tell you like this. I had clothes laid all over that room. If anybody had walked in, I was mixing and matching clothes. I was doing all this stuff. I finally got myself so worked into a lather like that I went back in and took another shower and put on some toilet water and, you know, I just... Anyway, I finally get dressed up, and it's 6 o'clock in the afternoon, in the middle of the summer in Dallas, Texas, and I drive a 77 Toyota Land Cruiser with no air conditioning. So I drove down to where Salvation Army is, which is right on Harry Hines between there and Parkland Hospital, and there's nothing but a sea of dope fiends, hookers, and one guy in a suit walking up and down Harry Hines trying to stay cool because I can't get in the facility till almost 8 o'clock. So I go in, get in the deal, walk in the facility, and now I'm a trained professional. I walk in, I go around and get it all collected up. I clear the security, and as I walk into the big gymnasium deal like this, in my mind's eye, it looked like a room about this big. It's not. It's maybe half this big, but it's a big old room. And when I walked around the corner, all of these men stood up and started walking towards me really quickly. Now, some of you guys that have been in bar fights and stuff, you've had some experience in bars. There's an appropriate speed to walk up to another man, and there's an inappropriate speed. I'm just a little piece of education you probably could never have done without. And so these kids are walking towards me really, really fast, and it scares me real, real bad. I had been put in the hospital once, one in Houston, Texas, for being in a place that I shouldn't have been doing something I shouldn't have been doing, and a couple of black guys beat me to a pulp, and I deserved twice what they gave me. Okay, it was a pretty ugly night, and I said some pretty unkind things, and I got what I deserved. But I was so terrified of these men that it just freaked me out. And so they stop right about where these chairs are. All of them stop, and one of them, the biggest one in the room, Natch, walks on towards me like this, and he walks right up to me, and I put my head back like this, and I put my arms out, and he just scooped down like this and picked me up and just squeezed me, and then he just picked me up off my feet. My feet aren't even touching the ground, and it's just like this, and I just... And I'm pushing real hard on this guy's chest, and I'm pushing, and I can't go like this. And then all of a sudden, I realize, hey, if this dude wanted to, if he wanted to squish me, he would have squished me. I mean, he would have thrown me around like a rag doll. I mean, he just like, and so I just kind of dropped my hands and like this, and just put my head over on his chest like this, and he just. He owned me, yeah. I didn't know what else to do, but let me tell you something. I've been held, my wife is the most gentle creature on the face of God's green earth, and I don't think I've ever been held more gently than that big old tall black guy did. And so he set me down, and when he set me down, my feet touched the ground like this, and I kind of looked up at him, and he leaned down, and he said, "We've been looking forward to you coming back all day long." And I went, "Well, me too. Me too." And all this stuff kind of connects up. And I began to sit there. And I felt like Jimmy Swaggart. I mean, I'm just up there like this. I got this big book. And I'm slinging every piece of AA I know. And we're all laughing. And they're all laughing. And they're asking questions like this. And it was just like we did this meeting. And I'm soaking wet, and they're soaking wet, and we're all just having this big old time like this. And I walked out of that place that night, and a bunch of these guys asked me to sponsor them, and I remember walking out, cleared security, and I got back out next to my Land Cruiser, and I leaned against that truck out there in the dark in that parking lot, and I cried like a little girl. I cried, and I cried, and I cried, because all of those years I'd been in AA, all of those years of sitting in meetings, all of those years of playing a game, I all of a sudden am a part of this. I no longer was I sitting there wondering if I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a bona fide card-carrying poster boy for AA. And it was the coolest feeling in the whole wide world, guys. And I'm telling you, it has never, ever changed. It's been like that forever. I don't care how many meetings you go to. I could care less. I want to know where you're going to carry the message. I want to know who you're helping. I want to know that kind of stuff. You see, because from that pile of work that doesn't make any sense, how could a bunch of busted up drunks affect me so dramatically? How does that happen? This is the stuff that gets me, guys, and it blows me away. And I've seen these examples time and time again. I'll get hundreds of calls a month from men who are struggling in AA, and the very first question I ask them is, I want to know two things. I want to know how much time you're spending with God in the morning, and I want to know how much time you're spending with God's kids every day. Well, I go to this meeting. No, it's not what I'm talking about. I want you someplace else. I sponsor over the years hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of men that I've carried through the steps who go to one meeting a week. Listen to me, guys. One meeting a week, and they've got a 12-step place that they go to carry the message. They're active in sponsorship. They're active doing 10, 11, and 12. They're doing what they're supposed to do around those disciplines. And these men are pictures of mental health. I'm not saying don't go to 10 meetings a day. If you can do it and you can work it into your lifestyle, rock on. Do it. Do it. I just want us to collectively start teaching new people when they come in here. I want you excited, and I want you on the firing line doing what we do. And there is plenty to do that doesn't revolve around just a meeting. That's all I'm trying to say. I'm not trying to get you to stop it. I just want you to add some other stuff maybe to it like this. And then see. You'll get your own balance, and you'll see kind of where you're going to be. Real quick, and then I'm done. I love to garden, and I have my whole life. I've always wanted to be a farmer, and in Texas, that's risky business because dry farming in Texas is a scary thing. And we're right on the edge of the Great Southwestern Desert, but nobody bothered to look. They label it farmland on the maps, and it's the edge of the desert. I mean, sometimes we get rain and sometimes we don't. So I'm not cut out of that kind of stuff. But I love growing stuff, and I can remember early in sobriety, early when I was doing this stuff, and I was going to that original group. I was staying so agitated inside, and at the end of the evening, I'd be out there in that garden. I'd be on my knees picking stupid bugs off these tomato plants, and I'd be just but it was all a chore. It was just all a beat, and I had to get this done, and I'd think about having to go back in there and see this beast of a woman that I'm married to. I got a bunch of little kids running in there that are driving me crazy. I got to get up in the morning and go to a job that I cannot stand. And the only thing that could be worse is my name is on the side of the building. And I hate it. I hate every piece of it. And I'm just not very happy. And there was an old dude, Cliff Bishop, that loved me enough to tell me the truth. He loved me enough right off the bat to tell me that I was arrogant, that I was selfish, that I was prideful. And he told me that if I didn't work those steps, that if I didn't find a relationship with the God of my understanding, that I was not going to make it. He loved me enough to tell me this. And I did exactly what he asked me to do, the way he asked me to do it. And my life was transformed. My life was changed. These days, it occurred to me one day, I was sitting in that same garden, different year, same garden, picking bugs off the tomato plants and trying to put some kind of thing together there. And I'm anxious and I'm thinking, oh no, there's that feeling again. And I went, wait a minute, that's not anxious because of the old stuff. It's new anxious stuff. And I started thinking about what it is that's going on. And I'm just sitting there on my knees thinking about this. And all of a sudden it hit me like a ton of bricks. In a couple of minutes, I get to go inside and see a woman that I absolutely adore. The finest woman on the face of God's green earth. I get to see a bunch of kids that I love, the smartest, prettiest girls in the universe. I get to get up at 4:30 in the morning and go to a job that I absolutely, I can't tell you how much I love that work. You understand what I'm saying, guys? Did the job change? Did my wife change? No, the kids didn't. My relationships with you guys didn't. It was just what changed was me. What changed was my insides. I was completely rearranged, and I began to understand. Folks, I got to tell you, I love you to death, and I just the fact that I'm sober today, I'm glad. I am. I couldn't be happier about it. But being sober pales in comparison to the fact that I get to live a life today that's useful. I get to live a life that's completely transformed. I get to do, say, go, see things that I never dreamed that I would do. I get to have relationships that are truly authentic. No disco crap. Truly authentic. And I got to tell you, man, to sit in a room full of people that love you and know that any one of them would take a bullet for you is you understand what I'm saying, guys? And that you would take a bullet from them. Or for them. That sounded pretty stupid. I may get a bullet from some of you guys before it's over, but it's like, if some of this stuff makes you feel uncomfortable, by all means, call me. Don't stay uncomfortable for anything. But next time you do a little piece of inventory, which I'm hoping is really, really quick, my name goes in column one, that old guy from Texas. Put him in column one, and then let's just work across this thing, and we'll get to the bottom of it, and we'll see. We're one generation removed from the beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous. My question to you, especially you young cats, my question is, will we make it another generation? Will we sustain our fellowship on just a bunch of meetings, or are we going to have to gather this up again and look harder and maybe get back in the text? That's what I'm hoping that we'll do collectively, okay? I love you, cats. I'll see y'all later. Oh, my stuff.